from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Casey Gerald grew up poor in inner city Dallas. He made it to Yale on a football scholarship and got an MBA from Harvard Business School. He's gone to Wall Street, D.C., and started a nonprofit for young entrepreneurs, all before the age of 30. But he doesn't want to be celebrated or have his story stand as proof of the American dream. As Gerald shares in his new memoir, earning these achievements has almost shattered him. Casey Gerald joins us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. It's good to be back with you after several months out on maternity leave and to introduce you this morning to Casey Gerald, whose story on the surface is an amazing rags-to-riches tale. A small-town Texas kid of a drug-addicted father and largely absent mother gets recruited by Yale to play football. Then he gets into Harvard Business School, where he delivers the commencement speech. He works for prestigious companies before starting his own organization, helping young entrepreneurs start small businesses, and he starts getting mentioned as a future president. But in his new memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here, Casey Gerald rejects the idea that his life is the embodiment of the American dream of hard work and playing by the rules leading to success. He grapples instead with how his story has been used by others, he says, to justify the status quo. Casey Gerald, welcome to Forum.
Hi, Mina. Good morning and welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And thanks for being here. I was really struck with the way your memoir opens. It opens during Y2K, December 31st, 1999, that time when we feared computers would crash, creating catastrophes like planes, you know, falling out of the sky or messing up water systems. That night, you're at an evangelical church, and you're 12 years old. Can you tell us what was going through your mind?
Well, while most people were waiting for the computers to crash, I was waiting for Jesus to return. And I don't know that it's so much that I feared it. I just thought it was going to happen for sure. And I start with that story in this book because it really, at base, was not just a religious exercise. By that point, my mother, who suffered from mental illness, had began to disappear. My father, who struggled with drug addiction, was also sort of in and out of my life. And I, as I write in the book, I didn't want the world to end. I wanted to be rescued. And if there is a theme that runs through this book and also through this moment, it's that in some ways the world that we inherited has ended, for better, for worse. And the big question is, what do we do? What do we turn to for rescue? Obviously, there are some people in the country turn into very dark and dangerous things for rescue. But I think the human impulse for something, for wanting something to save you, is very real. And I try to be clear about the cost of that while also being honest about the sort of noble parts of that desire.
Yes, and I really want to get into all of that with you. If you could, though, at that age of 12, what world were you inhabiting that you wanted to be rescued from at that time? What was it like?
Well, it's funny. I think the word that comes to mind is uncertainty. I write about my mother, who suffered from bipolar. It started to disappear when I was 12. And my mother was, in some ways, my human hiding place. I tell people she was like a mix of Blanche DuBois from A Streetcar Named Desire and a 1980s Whitney Houston. I mean, she was the most magical person I'd ever known. And she was the only person I knew that was as strange as me. And so she was almost like a great protector, you know, for me. And so when she started to disappear, it was very traumatic. And very disorienting, and no one talked to me about it. And I remember at that time, I had been a very messy kid, a sort of weird kid. But I got this idea that when my mother started disappearing, got this idea that if I walked the sidewalk squares perfectly from my elementary school at the top of a steep hill down to my grandmother's house and only put one foot in each sidewalk square and didn't put a foot on the line between the squares, didn't put 2 feet inside the square, then at some point, once I got home, if I walked it perfectly, my mother would be back. And it worked once. And so I almost had this sort of unconscious belief that if I was perfect, if I did everything right, then nothing would go as wrong as it already had. And obviously that does not work. But for a 12-year-old, it led to a pretty dangerous, I think, path of achievement, but also a path of conformity that that is prescribed for so many young people in this country.
You mean in terms of believing that Yale and Harvard were doing things right?
Not so much that. I say often that the muscle you develop as an orphan is in some ways, and excuse the language, the muscle of a whore. You quickly learn to do and say and be whatever it is that you feel you need to do or say or be because there needs to be some way to, you know, get you somewhere to stay or get some food or make people like you. When the closest people to you abandon you, that sort of wrecks your sense of value. So the connection from that to places like Yale and Harvard, of course, I didn't realize this for a very long time, but it really boils down to something that I heard. I was back on campus at Yale a few years ago, and a senior administrator was talking to a group of 50 freshmen, black boys from all across the country, all across the world, actually. And his message to them was, hey, if you're going to be a token, just be the best token you can be.
Wow.
And that broke my heart, Mina. And this was a group that I had founded when I was in college, the Yale Black Men's Union. And what I said to them afterwards, because I had learned it for myself, I said, listen, we've gotten very good at making great men. What we really need to figure out how to do is make free men, make whole men, and not just men, but young people. I've been on the road with this book for almost 3 months now, and a lot of schools, a lot of places, talking to young people about it. And what I have come to believe is that we're in the early days of a beautiful and dangerous revolution in terms of the way that we live in the world and the way that we're taught to live, the way we were, at least my generation was taught to live, was much like that kid walking those sidewalk squares. Hey, be perfect, be great. And often that comes at the expense of being whole and being free. And this book is not just a memoir, it's an intervention to stop that, to sort of disrupt that way of teaching and provide an alternate path.
Well, one of the ways that you do that is by saying that this message of being perfect is actually one that gets co-opted, one that gets used by others, by elites, essentially, to keep others down, to keep others from rising. And you have this excerpt in your book where you describe an encounter with President George W. Bush, which I think really illuminates what you're saying there. And I was wondering, Casey Gerald, if you wouldn't mind reading that encounter where you met him and the effect that it had on you.
Sure, sure.
And if you want to set it up a little bit, feel free.
Yeah, the setup is, you know, honestly not much help because it was as strange to me as it will sound to you in just a sec. But I was down in Dallas a couple years ago, and I was at the Bush Presidential Library for a program I was a part of, and I was standing in a buffet line. And I felt a hand on my right shoulder, and I turned around, and it was George W. Bush. And that honestly is about all the setup that that I had. I mean, it was pretty random. So we walked through the line, you know, start to chat. And then we get to the end of the buffet line, and he turns to me, and this is where the excerpt starts. Okay. Let me ask you something, he said. Scrunched his mouth. Was your dad around? This felt as out of the blue to me then as it may feel to you now. For 6 or 7 minutes, the president and I had run a pretty good gamut of gab, talked about his paintings and his school days and his brother Jeb, who was at that time campaigning poorly to be the 45th president. Yet after all that, Mr. Bush needed to know, or wanted to know, I'm trying not to speculate, whether I had grown up with a father. And since I had mastered the art of giving people exactly what I thought they wanted, which got me into a lot of trouble, not all of it bad, I replied, without even thinking much, "No, sir. Both of my parents were gone by the time I was 12, which, as we know, was not quite true, but not entirely untrue either. I don't remember what he said right after, but I do know, because there's video evidence, that 2 years passed and I remained on the president's mind. He was sitting on a stage in Beverly Hills being interviewed by a gentleman who had also been famous for a long time, first for his success in finance, then for the felonies, which had, in part, made the success possible, and finally, as is the American way, for his good deeds. The man wanted to hear about the president's latest good deed, a program that he and the 42nd president had launched around the time we met. Mr. Bush seized the opportunity to share, with a check-this-out flick of his hand, a case study. So I'm sitting next to a young African-American kid. So I said, "What do you do, man?" He said, he skips ahead. I said, "Where are you from?" He said, "Dallas." "Where?" "South Oak Cliff." The president lowers his voice as he tells this part. "South Oak Cliff, you know, on the other side of the Trinity River." Then resumes. I said, "Wow, did you go to college?" He said, "Yeah, I went to Yale." He does an all shucks shrug, voice low again. "That's where I happen to go." Then he looks down, continues. And I said, "Interesting. You know, you must have had parents who drove you." Then he looks up and out at the audience. He said, "Not at all. My dad died early. My mother's in prison. But I had an aunt that focused me. Plus, I was a pretty good football player." Anyway, so he goes to Harvard Business School and he applies to the program. Now, when I first heard the president's story, I thought, "Wow, that kid is impressive." Then I realized that the president was talking about me, and so I felt a bit confused and a little dirty, too. But I was not upset at all. Couldn't be. In our buffet line tete-a-tete, I had offered Mr. Bush a vague, compelling story, the kind of story I'd learned to tell at my lunches years before, though shorter and more to the heartbreaking point. And he, being the world-class politician that he is, took that raw material and fashioned an even more pointed and compelling version, so inaccurate that it became a new delicious story of its own, the kind of story a man needs if he's going to keep his subjects from despair or mass unrest or, most of all, from the truth about their society. I imagine that is one reason he became president, and I reckon it is also why so many of the lunch men and their wives said nice things to me like, "Casey, you are the embodiment of the American dream." But it took me many years to realize that instead of smiling and saying thank you, I should have wept.
That's Casey Gerald reading from his memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here. That line, "the kind of story a man needs if he's going to keep his subjects from despair or mass unrest, or most important, from the truth about their society." Can you explain that?
Well, when I say this book is an intervention, it is in many ways intended to turn this American dream narrative on its head, maybe kill Horatio Alger for all time to come. It's not so much that the American dream is false. It is that the American dream is a distraction. You take a kid like me from a forgotten world like Oak Cliff, you send him off to Yale and Harvard, all these things, and it distracts us from the American machine, you know, this conveyor belt that sends most young people, especially from neighborhoods like mine, but not just poor black inner city neighborhoods, even neighborhoods like J.D. Vance's in Appalachia, sends those young people from nothing to nowhere while picking off the chosen few like me. But one Casey Gerald cannot justify the suffering of so many children. The fact that 13 million kids live in homes without enough food to eat, that 1 in 30 kids don't have a stable place to live at all. So what I'm really trying to do with this book is to sort of get us not so much to stop believing in dreams and miracles. It actually is a very hopeful, jolly book for all the tragedy in it. But what I'm trying to do is help us to see with clear eyes the American reality. And there's a darker secret too, Mina, that this book is really, really trying to push into. Shortly after I began writing it. And I had started not because I wanted to be a writer necessarily, but because I was really cracked up. Even though I had achieved all these things, I felt really cracked up. And so I wanted to trace those cracks with words.
What do you mean by cracked up? I'm sorry, Case Gerald. What do you mean by cracked up?
I mean, I won't necessarily say I was having a nervous breakdown, but I wasn't too far off. And I was awful sad either way. I was crying a lot. My therapist looked at me with pretty... no crap eyes and said, yeah, it sounds like you were depressed. I had gone all this time without actually grappling with the things or trying to heal from the things that I'd gone through. I thought about your introduction. Actually, you said this process shattered him, almost shattered him. And it made me think of that great Hemingway line, you know, life breaks all of us. Some are just stronger in the broken places. Yeah. Yes. And I think that's true. And so when I talk about the intervention, actually, you know, how do we perhaps have a country or society that breaks fewer people and breaks us less dramatically? And also for those of us who are broken in so many ways, small and large, how do we start to heal that? And that became clear for me as an intention of this book when a few months into it, one of my closest friends from Yale, who had also gone on this sort of Horatio Alger journey, except from St. Louis, committed suicide.
Yes.
And I write about it in the book. He in some ways is the guardian angel of this whole work. And he came to me in a dream shortly thereafter. And he was sitting in a booth in a diner. And he said, Casey, you know, we did a lot of things that we wouldn't advise anybody we love to do. And then I woke up, but I knew exactly what he meant, Mina. I knew that if you look at it from the right angle, a kid picking themselves up by the bootstraps looks just like a suicide. As I've talked to more young people in my generation, the generation under, who are held up as the standards of success, I have become convinced that there is a whole generation of overachievers, probably a hell of a lot of them in San Francisco, who are suffering in silence and who have all the gold rings and a broken heart. And I don't think that bargain's worth it. And hopefully more of us can come out and say it's not worth it and we want to find a better way to live.
The cost or the suffering that comes from feeling like your existence or realizing your existence may have been used to justify keeping others down, but also it sounds like just the pressures of trying to meet the expectations of others, of a community. Did you feel that from your own community?
Sure. Yeah, I write in the book about when I first got into Yale, and there was a big, I'm from Texas where football is everything, and nobody,
yes.
Honestly, I didn't even know Yale had a football program, so I'm pretty sure nobody else knew. But still, this was this kid, our boy, even if they didn't know me, this was our boy who was going off to Yale, not just for himself, but for all of us. And we were out at National Signing Day ceremony in Dallas, and the groundskeeper of this stadium, he came up to me, and he was an older gentleman, and he said, hey, son, are you the boy they talking about going to Yale? I said, yes, sir. And he got off his little cart, and he came to me, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he started crying. And he said, go all the way, son. Go all the way. So I write in this book about the process of becoming a symbol. Yeah, and the slowly you realize that your silence holds the world together, that we in this country have substituted hopeful stories for justice. Yeah. So I write after that section about the symbols. I have something to tell you while there's still time. I am divesting myself of symboldom daily just by telling the truth. I don't have any, I'm not a propagandist. All I'm trying to do with this book, as someone who has lived America from the very bottom to the very top, is to report back as objectively as possible to show people how the country actually works. And hopefully, you think about a GPS system. People ask me all the time, hey, where do we go from here? The country's a mess. Where do we go? And I say, listen, the question is not where do we go from here? The question is, where is here? Every GPS system needs to know your current location. And I wanted to do that with this book. We live in a country that we have made choices that will lead to more and more suffering of children and people. But I think we can make different choices. And I think looking at the swearing in the Congress yesterday, I'm pretty optimistic that we can make better choices coming up pretty soon.
It's interesting to hear you say you're optimistic. I'm curious when you said earlier that we're good at making great men, but not free people, not whole people. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? What does being a free person mean?
Well, I think about it first and foremost. The most important act of it is an act of refusal. Yeah, I think about two things. A conversation with a young person, he was a sophomore in college. I think he was at Yale. He was one of these elite schools. And he said, "Do you have any advice for us, my peers?" And I said, "Well, what's on your mind?" And he said, "Well, I think many of us are wondering whether we can be all of who we are and still be successful." And that question just knocked me out. Hmm. And so I said, "Well, John, the real question is not, can you be all of who you are and still be successful? The question is, if you are not trying to be all of who you are, then what good is success?" See, the world, our society, teaches us to turn ourselves and our work into little nuggets, you know, to mutilate ourselves, to be acceptable to others, to be a stranger to ourselves so that we make sense to other people. You know? And so the right schools might accept us, or the right jobs might hire us, or the right parties might invite us. And someday, according to the religions, the right God might invite us to the right heaven and close his pearly gates behind us so we can worship forever and ever. These are the rewards, they say, for our obedience, you know, to be a well-liked holy nugget. And I think that's a death. So the first step in that, for me, is refusal, is to say no thank you.
But if you mm-hmm. refuse, Casey Jones, forgive me, some of the things that mm-hmm. you were offered, say the scholarship to Yale, if you did not have the benefits of these successes, you wouldn't have the platform you have right now, potentially, right? To be sharing or bearing witness or creating this intervention for others. So how do you bridge that the success that you have has actually, by doing everything quote-unquote right, has given you a voice, given you a platform, got you that TED Talk, got you this book deal?
Well, I think a great deal about a couple of biblical characters. I think about Jonah. And he says, "I escaped alone," is Job. "I escaped alone to tell thee." I don't know why all these things happen, but they happen, and here I am. So, hey, what am I going to do with it? I'm going to try to tell you as best I know. As Maya Angelou used to say, when you know better, you do better. So I'm trying to do better. I'm trying to tell the truth. That's first. But secondly, you think about Paul. The Apostle Paul is so effective in part because he says, and he was, the chief sinner of all. You know, so I think in some ways, if I am trying to get free as someone who was held up as a standard of the society, then I think that carries a little more weight than if I had just been sitting in obscurity for the last 31 years. At least I hope. But, you know, I can't choose the cards I'm dealt. I can just try to deal them better from here on out.
We're talking with author Casey Jerrold. His memoir is There Will Be No Miracles Here. What thoughts are coming to you as you hear Casey Jerrold talk? Have you ever been held up, recognized to mask the deficiencies in a system? Have you felt pressure to be a group's savior? Have you achieved things and wondered why you still feel unfulfilled? Give us a call, 866-733-6786, with your questions or comments, or post them on our website, on Facebook, or tweet us at KQED Forum. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Casey Jerrold, who Fast Company declared one of the most creative people in business. His TED Talk, The Gospel of Doubt, has been viewed nearly 2 million times. He opened for Barack Obama at South by Southwest. But Casey Jerrold was born into a broken family in small town Texas, and attending Yale on a scholarship changed his life. But in his first book, titled There Will Be No Miracles Here, Jerrold is grappling with how his story has been used, he says, to justify problems and suffering. Casey Jerrold, would love to go straight to calls because we're hearing from people. And I'm going to start with Camelia in Sebastopol. Hi, Camelia.
Hi, thank you so much for the show, and Casey, so much for your work. It's very powerful. My question, and I can take your answer off the air, is what you're sharing is groundbreaking in some ways and resonates really deeply, but how do you see in a practical way that we can apply what you're talking about kind of in a societal way? Are you envisioning it in schools, in households? Like, how do we take your story and use it to affect profound change.
Community
Thank
of
you
thanks.
Again.
Casey Gerald.
That's a fantastic question. Thank you for it. I think I love that old song, Lord, send a revival and let it begin in me. Yeah. The change, and this is, you know, the servant leadership deal, the problem is always in here. Yeah. So I remember I was out at the University of Iowa on book tour, and a young woman came up to me, and she said, you know, can you tell me, you know, how you reconciled your sexuality with your faith? And so we talked about that. And she came up afterwards and she said, I want you to pray for me. And I said, well, I don't know how to pray. And she said, well, I don't either. So I'll take whatever you got. So we sat there. It was the strangest thing. Me and this, you know, little girl, you know, probably 18, 19 years old, in the middle of Iowa, praying out of the blue after we've been told for most of our lives that we're damned for all eternity. I think that those kinds of interactions, whether they're in our homes or in our schools, that's the kind of profound change. I'm not talking about a curriculum. I'm talking about each of us signing up for the work, the daily work, from the time we wake up to the time we go to bed, and every interaction we have with people showing up in this way. But I do believe that we need fundamental reform in our universities. I mean, when the conversation I told you about earlier from that administrator who says, if you're going to be a token, be the best token you can be, there should not be an administrator on a college campus in America that has that mindset, or if they have that mindset, that is interacting with children with that language. And so I think if I had a practical wish list for 2019, that this book and this message would reach every young person in America through our schools, which need, as I've learned in my work with MBAs across America, need urgent reform, not, again, just in the curriculum, though we did build a curriculum that now is part of the schooling at Harvard Business School. It's not just a curriculum change, it's a mindset change, because we have not at all signed up for the goal of making free people. And I think if we sign up for that goal, then there are extraordinary minds in the country that can find very tangible, practical things, spiritual, material, and otherwise, to accomplish it.
It's interesting, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about the way that you chose to write this book. I feel like in that itself is an act of rebellion, or an act of challenging the way people expect you to be. Could you talk a little bit about how you chose to write this memoir differently? Because as I understand it, you originally started writing as an autobiography.
Well, sure. I remember the book started coming out about as strange as I felt at the time. And I sent it to a very respected writer who wrote back. He said, when can you hop on the phone? Which is always a bad sign, of course. And so, so we got on the phone and he said, listen, man, what is this? You've been hired to write an autobiography. It's a straightforward exercise. It's got a beginning, middle, and end. It's grounded in the facts of your life. And oh, by the way, there's a great tradition of autobiography in this country led by people on the margins of society who write to assert that they exist. Go out and buy some of those books. Learn from them. Because you're going in the wrong direction. Now, I was so grateful. This goes to your question about what does it look like to be free. I was so grateful for this conversation because it helped me realize I had no interest in writing that kind of book. I think about what Kendrick Lamar says on Section 80. I'm not on the outside looking in. I'm not on the inside looking out. I'm in the dead effing center looking around. That was the kind of book that I wanted to write. And I wanted to do with the genre sort of what Louis Armstrong does with Stardust. Yeah. For years and years, Stardust is this sort of, you know, jazz standard. It's almost like hospital music. It's horrible. And then Louis Armstrong comes and he blows the whole thing open. This little kid grew up in whorehouses in New Orleans, you know. And who wants to go back to the old Stardust? I thought that literature ought to represent the raw, strange magic of human experience, not just prove that we know a lot of words. So some of this, you know, before we can actually see the fruits of our labor, the dirt has to be good. I was listening to the CEO of General Mills, and he said, we're in the dirt business. If the dirt is good, everything we grow will be good. So much of this book is about trying to get my dirt to be good and then trying to let that out on the page, and disappoint, and being willing to disappoint expectations and being willing to refuse, as I've said, refuse all of those invitations to turn myself and my work into a nugget. But it came at a great risk. Mm-hmm. And I was so grateful to have an editor who held space for me. And so back to the caller's question, if we can hold space for more young people to be their highest and truest self, as strange and weird as that may be, and reduce the consequences of that, then that to me would be an extraordinary start, both in our homes and in our schools.
How much did being gay in small town Texas contribute to an inability to be free?
Oh, it's the greatest thing that ever happened. I mean, I'm very grateful.
Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, listen, you know, it is what it is. But what did Pangloss say in Candide? It's the best of all possible worlds. I write in the book, I would have been heartbroken if I had been born white. It took me a long time to feel the same thing about being gay, but it's true. You know, my uncle died of AIDS, and I write about this in the book, when I was 7. And my grandfather was a pastor, and we came from a very religious family and community. And I'll never forget, I saw him the night before he died, and the way that he and other people who were dying in this plague were treated and discarded. And that came with a promise that you're going to die in this gruesome way, and then you're going to go to hell. And it was as simple as that. And as I say often, being homosexual was the greatest gift that I could have imagined, because there was no reconciling so many things. So I had to, for example, let go of the God that I was given to find the God that I needed. And so in some ways, this book is fundamentally a queer book. Yeah. And it wouldn't be as strange and hopefully as impactful as it is if I had not spent so much of my life trying to find ways to live in context that seem to preclude any living. And I think that when people ask me, oh, it's not a hopeful book, I think it's an extraordinarily hopeful book. It's just not a book full of lies, I hope.
Well, Elle tweets, thank you for putting into words the complex interplay of social expectations, the personal quest for success, and the pain and beauty of finding our identity. My jaws ache. I've been there. I still am. I get it. Anita writes, 1, I agree with everything you say about freedom. 2, do you know about imposter syndrome?
I do know about imposter syndrome. It's interesting, though. I was in London a couple weeks ago, or whenever that was, and I saw on the cover of the Guardian's weekend magazine an interview with Michelle Obama saying she still feels like an imposter sometimes. To be honest with you, I don't really understand that. Not that I don't understand Mrs. Obama. I'm saying I don't personally totally feel like an imposter, but in part because when I first got to college, I knew I didn't know nothing. So it wasn't that I was an imposter. I was just really lucky. So I was just looking around, and it took me a few years. You know, I didn't start reading until I was almost 23. And so my whole thing was to listen to people, to watch people. And I had been doing this since I was a kid. It was the basis of my survival. And as I listened and as I watched, not just at Yale, but at Lehman Brothers in 2008, in D.C. in the early years of the Obama administration, traveling 40,000 miles across the country, sitting at dinner tables with George Bush, what I realized is that nobody else knew nothing either. So I didn't understand why I should feel like an imposter and everybody else should feel like an emperor. I feel pretty good. And this goes again back to that. That caller was fantastic. I was raised by people, especially teachers, who believed and said every day that I mattered. And to live in a society that hates black people, to live in a society that hates gay people, to live in a society that hates poor people, and to still have somebody, even if it's just one somebody, in your life every day that says and means and shows that you matter is perhaps the closest thing to salvation we'll ever have in this lifetime.
Well, Again, if you want to talk with Casey Gerald, his memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here, you can call us at 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your comments on Facebook or Twitter. Let's go to Charles in Oakland. Hi, Charles.
Thank you. The idea of the imposter syndrome resonated with me because in order to succeed oftentimes in the white world, as Gerald was talking, is that you have to do and be certain things. It makes perfectly clear that someone would commit suicide after some point in time when you live such an inauthentic life. And people are so willing to support us in living inauthentic lives, basically living lies, and working in the school system. It's a system, and things need to happen a certain way. And if you step out of line, you'll get rejected or you'll get fired or whatever the case might be. That's what issues of homophobia, heterosexism, misogyny, these things force people to live in certain ways. And Nina asked the question about, well, you got a Harvard degree and you got all these wonderful things. You know, didn't the system give you something? Well, the problem is that the problem is the issue of authenticity. And I think the story that I'm hearing here is so powerful. In the school districts, they have all these little programs like the African American Males Achievement Program or these programs. These programs don't work. But people know that if you put those words out there and you play these certain games and you have this and you have that, that's all inauthenticity. And the school systems, it's almost impossible to be authentic in the school system because it is a system. And if you move the wrong way, you know, you're going to lose out. So there are a lot of programs. And we'll look across the country. We've got these programs, and we hold these people up as being, you know, the archetypes. Look at this guy. He's wonderful and this sort of thing. And we watch them fall. You know, so I really don't know when you have a system. Because the system itself has to change because it's designed to do whatever it's designed to do, whether it's designed to wash dishes or whether it's designed to wash clothes. It's a system. When you put it in, it's going to come out the same way. So the system has to be changed. Sure. And I'm just curious about what Gerald thinks about that.
Charles, thanks so much.
Charles, thank you. Somebody get this guy a book deal. This is great. Hey. I write, this is a sports book to a certain degree, yeah, and I write a lot about football, high school and college, both my experience and my father's, who was still considered one of the greatest high school football players in the history of the state of Texas, went on to play at Ohio State. Anyway, I write about my freshman year at Yale. The team was horrible. Just really embarrassingly bad, and about a dozen of us freshmen decided to stage a coup, and we said, these guys suck and we're not going to do this anymore. So we went in the spring of our freshman year, spring practice, and we basically showed up every day determined to take their jobs. And we outran them, we outhit them, we stopped listening to them, we only listened to each other. And by the end of the spring, beginning of the fall, we had taken over the team. We went on to be the winningest class in a generation, won a championship. I tell that as a metaphor for our moment. I really try to avoid abstraction in the book if you read it. And so try to get down to the brass tacks. I think we're in a very similar moment in this country. Again, look at that picture of the swearing in of the 116th Congress yesterday. We've got a lot of people in positions of power with bad ideas and incompetence, and they have to be replaced. And I think they are being replaced, and the ideas are being replaced. And I think that we can stage to Charles's point, if the system doesn't work, the system is a manifestation of people, and personnel is policy. So I think if there's any hope, it's that just as those 18, 19-year-old boys showed up every day and kicked those upperclassmen's butt and took their jobs and made the team a better team, we can do the same thing in the country, not just in the Congress, but in your local communities. So if you've got a problem with the ideas that are being executed for your children in your neighborhood, all you got to do is show up every day and get the people out of. Not all you have to do, but it is at base.
Work.
Exactly. Well, but it's possible.
Well, Susan says, I believe our religiously capitalist country trains people to worship money and don't want young people to become the best self they can, but want them to be human widgets. We are expected to be useful to the state rather than honorable to ourselves. Casey Joel, can I just ask you, though, on this question of authenticity and being who you are, oftentimes I hear echoes of this and also people who defend rugged individualism against thinking broadly about social needs. So how do you have this authenticity and at the same time still think about the group if anybody feels like they have to make a choice or one comes at the sacrifice of the other?
I, to be very honest with you, Mina, I'm not entirely sure what this word authenticity means. Mm. I know what it means. You know, I did go to college, but in terms of, it just feels a bit too abstract for me. It goes a bit to Charles's point about suicide. There's a great part in James Baldwin's Another Country, and the protagonist, I mean, this is a spoiler, but whatever, the protagonist commits suicide, and he's a kid from Rufus's, from, you know, the sort of, you know, holiness church in Harlem. And so his funeral comes, and the minister has a very hard job. He's got to eulogize a kid who's committed suicide in a place where people say, oh, well, you committed suicide, you go to hell. So he preaches this incredible sermon. He says, listen, I know a lot of people that took their own lives and are walking the streets today. And some of them are sitting in the seats of the mighty, and some of them are preaching the gospel. He says, and if there wasn't so many dead folks walking around, maybe those of us trying to live wouldn't have to suffer so bad. And that gets to the core of what I'm saying. I mean, what I'm really trying to say, and I have a line in the book that says, I have a radio. It only plays two stations, life and death. I turn the death off now that I know the sound, the diddy bop of death. I sit in silence if I have to. Yeah. What I'm trying to get to for myself and through my work is what it means to live. This authentic thing, I guess it's part of it, but it's a bit too abstract for me. I guess I'm just too much of a simple person. I don't believe you can have a full life that is truly living with a capital L, not just paying your mortgage, if you are not working every day, just as I said to that kid, John, to be your full self. And I believe that being your full self is also being in service to other people. I don't think that's just a Christian ethic. I don't think anybody is truly happy if all they're thinking about is themselves. So I don't know that it's hard, but I'm not sure it's as complicated as we sometimes imagine. Mm-hmm. That, oh, if you're trying to live in your fullest, truest self, you then will be, you know, slicing everybody's throat. I think that's a bit of
a false
cynical
choice.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's a false choice. Yeah.
Armando in Kensington. Hi, Armando. Join the conversation.
Hi. Thanks, Casey, for your story. I really appreciate you and the story you're telling and the courage it took to tell that story. I also came from a very somewhat similar background. My father was murdered when I was an infant. My mother suffered from bipolar disorder her entire life, and I suffered from the stigma of bipolar disorder my entire life with my mother's illness. And the one thing that I've come through, now I'm successful. I'm a partner at a law firm, and I've gone through all of this from being at the very bottom, and not but for a lot of luck and a lot of hard work and a lot of support from my grandmother who raised me, who had an eighth grade education from Puerto Rico, I would not have been a successful individual in my life with my own family. And one thing that I struggle with is I'm struggling with the idea of survivor's guilt, if that resonates. The idea of I have family members like a brother, basically, who's going through his own struggles and, you know, in and out of in the prison system and the issues with addiction and issues with depression, quite frankly, because we had similar backgrounds. And I made it through a lot of luck and a lot of hard work and a lot of love and support from the family that I remaining that I had that were able to help me. But standing where I'm at, I still see my family and people like me, and they, but for whatever, you know, for different reasons, weren't able to succeed or go through that. And it's almost a daily reminder as I walk into my law firm that I own as a partner that I was lucky. This system is made to ground people down. And you struggle with that. Like, how was I so lucky? How did I get here when other people who are more accomplished, you know, smarter, more capable in other ways weren't able to, and struggling with that on a daily basis, thinking about that. And then, as a reminder, you have your own flesh and blood going through these struggles.
Sorry to cut you off, but very compelling point about survivor's guilt. And I just wanted to give Casey Gerald a chance to comment on that question you had put forward.
Yeah, thank you for that call, Armando, and thank God for your grandmother. I think two words came to mind as you were talking. One is sadness and the other was love. It's so important, as much as this book is about rebelling, it also is about remembering. Yeah, remembering my friend Elijah who took his life, remembering all the young people that I grew up with who were, quote unquote, left behind, you know, forgotten, abused, neglected. I cry more readily after writing this book than I ever thought I'd be able or willing to. But I don't cry out of despair. Yeah, it's a sort of a calm, grateful cry. And part of our culture is very hostile to the full range of human emotions. And so we put these very sort of scholarly terms on what are human experiences. And so I don't think so much about survivor's guilt, because, again, it's a bit too abstract for me. But I do think about sadness. I miss my friend a great deal. I miss so many of my friends I grew up with. And I try to remember them, and I try to honor them every day. And I try to avoid, there's a great Christian mystic, Richard Rohr, I try to avoid the impulse, as he talks about, to escape negative feelings. You know, I think our sadness is core to our magic. So that's one. And the other piece is love. You know, my mother disappeared when I was 13. It was the worst thing that ever happened to me. She was gone for 5 years. I write in the book, when she returned, my sister found her, tracked her down. When she returned, I wanted to disfigure her. I mean, I hated her so tremendously. So much of what I've tried to do is to forgive my parents, and try to build a muscle for them, for myself, of love. And so often, sometimes my mother calls and I ignore her for 4 or 5 days. And I say, okay, God, answer the phone, you know. And, you know, and she'll say, hey, you know, you're the only person I can talk to. And so often I'm tempted to say, well, where were you when I needed to talk to you? You see what I'm saying? That's the small Casey. But the Casey that's trying to learn how to love is the Casey that can show up on the phone and listen to my mother and be there, not in some sort of charitable position, but be there and actually care. And Armando, that takes a hell of a lot of work some days. But I think that's the work that I'm talking about. I mean, this is a very political book in a lot of ways.
Yes.
But to be honest with you, I mean, you know,
it's
far
story.
More about the personal
yes.
human experience of being alive. And I think sadness and love are very core muscles that I'm still trying to build, and I hope I wish you all the best in building it for yourself.
Armando, thank you. And I do have to say, yes, it is a very personal story, and I can't help at times as I read it wonder if you just are putting so much responsibility on yourself, right? It seems you put a lot on your shoulders, Casey Gerald, in terms of what your existence means and has meant. But I want you to respond to Sheila's question. What are your thoughts, she writes, on young African-Americans who seem to reject education achievement as trying to be white? How do you encourage them to be themselves in an education system that in many ways does not validate their existence?
Well, I think when I talk about this beautiful and dangerous revolution that we're in the early days of, it's a very interesting thing. Because you have to understand the context that these young people are operating in. You can't just say, oh, well, go and value your education or whatever. You have to understand the context of being a black person in America. It'll be 400 years this year since we got here, were brought here from Africa as enslaved people. And the basic premise for that whole time was that if you conform to the standard of the society, if you get an education, if you learn how to speak the language, if you're clean and articulate, if you pay a mortgage, et cetera, get married, then at some day, at some point, we will treat you as a full and equal human being. We might even let you be president. Well, the beautiful thing about being a young black person in America in this time, in the 21st century, is that we finally learned that you can do all of those things, everyday citizens. So I think it's a bit ridiculous, actually, to try to convince a 12-year-old black kid in this America that they need to grow up and be more reasonable about their future. I think what we really ought to do is try to convince Americans, citizens, white people, people in power, adults, think about the humanity and future of these young black children. I think it's a very cruel thing to expect that the country will be saved by children while the adults sit on the sidelines twiddling their thumbs saying, oh my God, aren't they so wretched?
Casey Gerald, we just have 30 seconds or so left. And at the very beginning, I mentioned that I wanted to ask you about how you said you were optimistic. Give us, as we go out, what are you optimistic about?
Well, I'm optimistic about talking to you. I mean, this has been very great. So why not be optimistic? But I think the human record is on the side of optimism. And at base, as Camus said, I wake up every day and have to decide whether to shoot myself or have a cup of coffee. And I want to have more coffee. So I'm committed to doing everything I have to do to get to that next cup. That's all.
Casey Gerald's memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. Stay with us for another Hour of Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.